The gospel passage we just heard today, often referred to as the testing of the Messiah, comes to us with a couple of caveats from modern biblical scholars. The first is that it is not to be conceived of as a precise or literal historical narrative. The writer of this gospel had another intention. The point here is not to further the biographical story of Jesus, but rather to help identify Jesus as the Son of God, and what does that mean? Scholars tell us that this story resembles similar rabbinic stories called Haggadic Midrash, which were fanciful stories whose purpose was to help the reader, or the listener, interpret the larger narrative. What we learn from this passage, this Midrash, is not a blow-by-blow account of how Jesus defeated the devil, but rather we hear a story that conveys the divinity of Jesus and the sonship of Jesus to God. Indeed, just before this story, we witness the baptism of Jesus and we hear God say, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." The gospel story we heard today therefore underlines this relationship, that of Jesus as the Son of God, and it underlines it in a dramatic way. The second qualification we hear from New Testament scholars is that this reading, which is appropriated always for the first Sunday of Lent, is perhaps not the best choice for such an occasion. Lent is a time of reflection, of penitence, and it is unlikely that modern-day Christians will relate to what is happening to Jesus in this story with the experience of their everyday lives. We do not come face to face with an observable character that we would call the devil, nor we are spirited away from place to place by the said character, nor does the temptations Jesus faced have anything to do with our limited temptations in our limited humanity. It is very unlikely that an obvious and undisguised devil is going to ask you or me to rule the world with them. However, I think there is a very important link here. In fact, I would say a crucial link here between what Jesus faces in this story and what we face on our own human journey. The devil says to Jesus, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." Jesus says, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God." That is to say, "I will do the will of God, not of you, the devil." Then the devil says to Jesus, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself off this tower, knowing that the angels will save you." And Jesus answered, "It is not necessary to test God. God is like a parent of a child." Finally, the devil says to Jesus, "I will give you all the kingdoms of the world if you bow down to me." And Jesus answers, "I worship and serve only God." At that, the devil disappears. The temptation Jesus faces here, and that we ourselves face, is to treat God as less than God. As humans, we are consistently and continually tempted to underestimate or deny or mistrust or negate altogether God's willingness and readiness and eagerness to enable us to face our own particular trials. As St. Paul said in the book of Romans, if God is for us, who is against us? What happens is that we forget what we can really mean when we say God is for us and move forward on that certainty. I would like to explore this notion for a moment, this idea that we are tempted to put aside God's desire to help us in times of our trial. It is clear why non-believers in God would reject the help of the Almighty. They don't believe, and from their perspective, there is obvious no benefit or merit in putting any trust in an existence that for them does not exist. However, what I am interested in is exploring why believers, like you and me, would put aside or lean away from God's help. Please note that when I say believer, I am referring to the whole spectrum of belief in God. You may have faith as small as a mustard seed. You may have faith as small as a mustard seed from time to time and none at all. Or it may be as grand as Mount Everest. It doesn't matter. All that matters for my exploration here is that from time to time, you have some faith. And so you do. You have some faith. But why is it that in times of trouble, God is sometimes the last person that we look to for help, for support, for healing and peace? There is a joke, which I'm about to tell you, about someone with little or no faith in God. He was on a boat fishing in one of those deep lakes in northern Scotland. Early in the morning, and he's the only one on the lake. All of a sudden, the Loch Ness Monster jumps out of the water and grabs him, holds him up, and is about to swallow him whole. And the man says, "God, oh God, help me." And in that instant, the Loch Ness Monster's gone. He's back in his boat. And it's like nothing ever happened. And a deep voice from the heavens booms out and says to this man, "You say you don't believe in me, but now you are asking for my help." And the man of little faith looked up and said, "Well, 10 seconds ago, I didn't believe in the Loch Ness Monster either." I don't intend to place too much theological importance on that particular story, but it does underline two reasons why believers are tempted, perhaps, not to let God be God. The first is that God, unlike in the story, does not regularly come to us in an obvious fashion. The fact is that we don't overtly see or hear God. We can't reach out and physically touch God. And God does not, as far as I know, communicate with us by email or cell phone. God speaks to us, rather, in small, quiet, silent ways. Through our thoughts, through our intuitions, through our dreams and our prayers, through our hopes and inspiration, and through our communication with each other, to name just a few. When we are in trouble, we tend to like immediate solutions that have concrete results, and God, seemingly, does not quite fit that bill, or at the very least, does not come to our mind immediately. The other reason the story of the man of the Loch Ness highlights our inclination not to make God a partner in our times of everyday need is a little more subtle, but perhaps even more significant. It is the element of trust. Do you trust God? Do you trust God? Do you trust in God a little bit, a great deal, or does it depend on the circumstances? I have heard many people say sometimes something along these lines. I believe in God. I believe in God's love for all people and all things, but I just can't take that extra step and accept that God can and would intervene in my life to make it better. That, I think, is the real issue. We can accept God as a God of love in the wider sense, in a universal sense. But when it comes to us, well, surely God has better things to do. I confess, in my own process of conversion, this was one of the issues that I had the most problem with, that God could be a personal God and truly love me and help me. I'm about to tell you a true story, which I'm sure you've heard in many different versions, in many different ways before, but it's important, I think, to hear it again. And I'll close with this story. On the 10th of May in the year 1748, a captain of a sea merchant ship was plying the waters off the coast of Sierra Leone, Africa. For many reasons, he was racked with guilt and hated his life and felt that his life in general was ugly and not worth living. He had committed unspeakable deeds against his fellow human beings, all in the pursuit of money. He was a slave trader, and on this night, May 10, 1748, he had a full complement of slaves. They were in their compartments, which were not much larger than a coffin, and chained and shackled so they could not move. On that night, a great storm came up, and the captain was struggling to keep the ship afloat. In a moment of almost complete despair, he seriously contemplated letting the ship go, letting it slip into the storm and into the sea, and ending his wretched life. His journey to this point had made him a man of very, very little faith. But in that moment, he realized that there was more life on that ship than just his own. In that moment, he also realized that perhaps his life could be changed. So he fell on his knees and out loud said these words, "Lord, have mercy upon us." Later in the cabin, after the storm had abated, he reflected on what he said, and he began to believe that God had addressed him through the storm and that grace had begun to work for him. For the rest of his life, he observed the anniversary of May 10, 1748, as the day of his conversion, a day, he called it, of humiliation, in which he subjugated his will to God. He left the slave trade business, became an Anglican priest, and was also a leading figure in the abolishment of slavery. He wrote a hymn to commemorate that night, and his name was John Newton, and he wrote the hymn and lyrics to Amazing Grace. What John Newton got absolutely right was that he was saved by grace. What I think we often forget is that God's love for us is unconditional, and it is poured out to each and every one of us in an equal measure, which is to say, an unlimited amount. God's love is free and always flowing, and all we have to do is accept it. What John Newton did in his moment of great despair was to let God be God. I think that when we are tempted not to ask God for help, it is not so much that we don't think God's help is available to us, it is because we are generally reluctant to ask for help altogether. John Newton called his conversion a day of humiliation, in which he handed over his will to God. Perhaps that is what is required of us, to be humble and to admit from time to time that we need God's help, and then allow God to take care of things that we have no control over anyway. God's grace is personal, and it is there for each and every one of us. When was the last time that you sat down in a conversation with God and said, "There are things that are before me right now, and I could really use your help. I leave them with you, O God. I know you love me and will guide me, and I thank you for that." If you haven't had that kind of conversation with God lately, I think the first Sunday in Lent is an excellent time to do just that. As John Newton wrote, "Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace that brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home." Amen.